Let's go ahead and get started. We are in Zechariah chapter 4. And we covered three chapters last week. I think we might be able to cover three chapters again this week. And these are more visions that we're going to see today, starting in chapter 4. Then the angel who was speaking with me returned and roused me as a man who is awakened from his sleep. And so he's getting ready to have another vision, but he's kind of groggy. You know, when you just first wake up, you're like, can you imagine? Here's an angel of the Lord getting ready to give you another one. It's like a day at the office for this guy.
It's as, but he didn't say he was actually sleeping, though.
No, it says as.
As the man come out of
mm-hmm. So he's a little, you know, here's what I thought. Spiritual awakening, but do you remember, most of you guys are about the same age. Remember I dream of Jeannie or Mona, and they go, ooh. They have that little foggy thing, and you go, you know, like they were dreaming back. And the first thing I thought of was it, ooh. So he's transferring from this way of thought to this way of thought. So I know that's a little hokey, but he wasn't asleep as awakened from sleep. And he said to me, what do you see? And I said, I see and behold a lampstand of gold with its bowl on the top of it and its seven lamps on it with seven spouts belonging to each of the lamps which are on the top of it. Also two olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl and the other on the left side. Then I answered and said to the angel who was speaking to me, saying, what are these, my Lord? Now you tell me what these are before y'all read on farther ahead now. Come on.
It's menorah.
Yeah.
In the from the Old Testament, it'll be the menorah. You got seven individual lampstands feeding one. Of course, Revelation 1:20 is the seven. It talks about seven churches. The lampstands are seven churches, or one church. It's talking about in Revelation. So,
well, you're right on that. That it is talking about the implements of the church, mm-hmm. And there's lots of different ways to read the symbolism in this, and we'll talk about it as we go along. But you're right, it's the lampstands that are within the church. One of the hardest jobs in the temple, I'm saying the church, in the temple was to keep the lampstands filled, to keep the wicks trimmed, to keep all that stuff running. I mean, it was kind of tedious to keep all these things. And what he's got here is, you got olive trees growing right beside it, filling the lamps with olive oil. It's not really possible, but it's symbolism. Okay. Then he answered and said to me, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel, if you remember, is the civic leader of Israel that when the people have returned back. So he's not the priest, but he's the civic leader, the mayor, the king, the whatever you want to call him. This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. And we've heard that. How many times have y'all heard that? Not by might, not by spirit. Not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. One of the things I want you to realize here is that the might focuses on collective strength and resources of a group or army. Power focuses on the individual strength. God says, not by the resources of many or one, but by my spirit. It will be by not by your cleverness or your ability, or your physical strength, and the temple will be rebuilt, but by my spirit, says God. Verse 7, what are you? Am I right? Verse 6, then he answered and said to me, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by my... Okay, says the Lord of hosts. Verse 7, what are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you will become a plain, and you will bring forth the top stone with the shouts of grace, grace to it. Also the word of the Lord came to me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things? But these seven will be glad when they see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. These are the eyes of the Lord, which range to and fro throughout the earth. Then I answered and said to him, what are those two olive trees on the right of the lampstand and on its left? And I answered And I answered a second time and said to him, "What are the two olive branches which are beside the two golden pipes which empty into the golden oil from themselves?" So he answered me, saying, "Do you not know what these are?" And I said, "No, my Lord." Then he said to me, "These are the two anointed ones who are standing by the Lord of the whole earth." So now what are we talking about?
Some people think it's Moses and Elijah. And I think, isn't that one of the comments? And another, in Revelation, this is discussed in Revelation chapter 11. It talks about the two anointed ones that will return before Christ does, and they will be killed in the streets. But I believe it's on up into chapter 11. It talks about the prophets. It talks about the prophets and the saints. And I think that's who the two anointed ones are that make up the many member body of the church. So that's me.
Somebody suggests the anointed ones were Joshua and Zerubbabel, dedicated to this special task. But then it goes on to say in Revelation, it could also be two witnesses that arise to prophesy the nations during the time of tribulation, and they will be killed by the rising man.
I'll give it to both of you.
Let me read my commentator. It said, which kind of pulls this together, and I'm glad you came at it from two different ways, because yes, you're both right. In Zechariah's day, the two anointed ones were Zerubbabel and Joshua. It seems that they were not the entire trees, but two olive branches from the trees, probably one branch from each tree. The trees themselves may represent the kingly and the priestly offices of Israel. Okay. You know, this is going to be kind of strange in chapter 6, because the priests and the kings were not supposed to be, who was it, Uzziah, that wound up doing some priestly things and wound up having leprosy for the rest of his life. They were not supposed to cross. You were either a priest or you were a king. And what this is doing is setting up a time when we will have a priest king, which is the return of the Messiah. All this symbolism is going on right now. But in this one, it says God had a special work for these two anointed ones. They would be uniquely anointed to work together to accomplish the work of God. God often calls two men to work together: Moses and Aaron, Joshua and Caleb, Elijah and Elisha, Peter and John, Paul and Barnabas, Calvin and Luther, Whitfield and Wesley. And, you know, they had a few more that even I didn't know. So I know once we started getting into Whitfield and Wesley and...
Oh, really?
Yeah, Barrows, and I can't remember. I didn't copy them down. Then it says, God promises to raise up two more witnesses, anointed ones, to preach the gospel to the world immediately before Jesus' return. That's through Revelations 11:3 through 13. And in Revelations 11:4 specifically says, of these witnesses, these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. Talking about the two witnesses during in the Revelation. The two anointed ones had work to do, and it would be so supplied by the Spirit of God that they would be like the olive trees with a continual supply of oil for the lamps on the lampstands. Anointed ones is literally sons of oil. So, but they're being fed by the Spirit. So they're not doing this in their own power. They're being fed by the oil is symbolic of the Spirit of the Lord. I like that one a whole lot. How about you guys? Isn't that pretty cool? Chapter 5. Any questions or comments about... I mean, I know we could probably spend a month studying each one of these visions. We're not gonna. We're just hitting the top form of it, but I think we got a little bit out of that one.
So the Great Mountain in verse 7, mm-hmm. I assume they're talking about Babylon.
Well, you know,
the mother of harlots.
We're going to come up on that when we go to the woman in the basket. But let me see if I can find it here, because I kind of skimmed over that. For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. The seven are the eyes of the Lord mentioned in the same context. They rejoice when they see Zerubbabel busy with the building work with the plumb line in his hand. The eyes of the Lord see it all, and they are happy to see God's people at work. Though the work was empowered by the Spirit of God, Zerubbabel still needs his plumb line. He still needs to get to work. God could have given Zerubbabel a shortcut and instantly, miraculously finished the work. that isn't God's way of doing things, because his work in the life of Zerubbabel was as important to him as his work in the work through the life of Zerubbabel, work through Zerubbabel. I didn't answer it. I thought it was, there was another one that said, when they got back and they, remember they did the foundation and did like, you know, 2 years worth of work, and then they've been 18 years now that they haven't done it. I can't remember the exact time. But the, in that time, that whole area had been filled back up. It had been filled up with trash and with debris. And so basically what they're going to have to do is kind of clear that off before they can start work. And that was what making it, taking the mountain down to it. And to make this so that it's not a mountain, supposedly, another one said that if you do it in the Spirit of the Lord, that this mountain that you think you can't climb becomes like a plane, because you're not doing it in your own strength. You're doing it in the Spirit of the Lord. He gives you that power. And so it won't be like you're climbing a mountain. It'll be like you're just walking along, because you've got that. That was two different ways to look at that. Okay. Anybody else? Chapter 5. This is the flying scroll, not the flying squirrel. The flying scroll. Then I lifted up my eyes again and looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll. And he said to me, "What do you see?" And I answered, "I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits and its width 10 cubits." Then he said to me, "This is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side. I will make it go forth, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely by my name, and it will spend the night within that house and consume it with its timber and stones. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see what this is going forth. And I said, what is it? And he said, it is an epaph going forth. Okay, let's stop right there. So you got this flying scroll.
Like a banner.
Well, or, you know, a scroll at that time could have been a banner. Mm-hmm. Or one of the things had said that the reason this is so long, if you had a scroll, the scrolls were what you read the Testaments from at that time. But normally, if you've ever been in a Jewish synagogue, they unroll it, and they roll it back up as they're unrolling it. So you only have a certain portion that's out at any one time. You don't have that stretched all the way across the place, where this one is stretched. And it is stretched 15 feet by 30 feet, or 20 cubits by 10 cubits. These were the dimensions of the holy place and the tabernacle and the porch of Solomon's temple. So the symbolism there is that this was the word of the Lord. This was the commandments of the Lord. And I didn't follow this completely, but it says, every thief shall be expelled, every perjurer shall be expelled. This indicates that the text on the scroll contains the Ten Commandments. To steal was to injure your neighbor. To perjure was to dishonor God, because you had sworn in his name. And he says, I will send out a curse. The two sins, one from each side of the tablets of the Ten Commandments, represent all of Israel's sins. God will curse the people who commit these sins and their house. So that's their interpretation of what was going on. Questions or comments? I know this is kind of hard. Let's talk about visions and curses and scrolls and try to make sense out of it where we really can. Okay.
But you think it made sense to them at the time?
It didn't. I don't think it did. I mean, it might have to Zechariah, who was trying to influence. Now, you take this whole thing. It's just like,
what was his background knowledge? I mean, what was Zechariah coming up with? Oh, there's a flying scroll, so that must mean that God's trying to tell me.
And the good thing is he's asking him most of the time, don't you see what that means with the two olive trees? And he's like, I'm not getting it. I love it. If we could put it in today's terms, he's like, I ain't getting it. And the guy goes, look, it's two olive trees. One's feeding the other one. It's going to be a branched off. Don't you get that? And he goes, oh, okay, yeah, now I kind of get it. Well, then go forth and tell Zerubbabel that this is getting ready to happen. And the good thing is Zechariah does. He goes to them and says, this is what God has said, and this is kind of what he means, and he wants you. We're leading up to something here in chapter 6 that's pretty awesome that I had never read before. So I'm kind of stoked, and I wish I had more time at the end of my study today to do more research on this. But it was kind of, and I may, when I get back, do more research on this, because I had never heard this particular thing. The crown. Anyway.
So here, is he just really kind of is God really just trying to reemphasize the Ten Commandments? If you just knock it down to the simple.
He's trying to get them to turn back. As Philip would say, they've just come out of Babylon. So they are still very worldly. If they weren't, now these are the best of the best. These are the Marines that are coming in. These are the, you know, no offense, but these are the I want to say Rangers or Green Berets or SWAT team or whatever. These are the best of the best that are going back into Jerusalem, yet they fall so short. So they're not living up to what they want to. And God is basically saying, let's strip this back down to the basics. And so, yeah, he's saying, go back to our foundation. Go back to what brings us to where we are right now. You've come back out of Babylon. You need to turn your back on that, and we're going to see this in the next little piece, and go back to what I told you, which are the Ten Commandments, which is, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the commandments. And he's broke it down into two here, just like Jesus breaks it down into two. Love God, love your neighbor. And all the Ten Commandments can be broken down into those, five for one and five for the other. So let's continue. Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, lift up now your eyes and see what is going forth, verse 6. And I said, what is it? And he said, this is an Ephah going forth. Ephah, I can't ever say that right. But do you know what the E-P-H-A-H is?
Sign of commerce, isn't
it? It is a sign of commerce. Right. But this was also, an Ephah was a measurement.
Yeah.
And that was used in the they have an Ephah of grain, an Ephah of oil, or I can't say the word correctly. But is yours, has y'all got something different?
Mine says basket.
Basket?
Weight of lead.
Well,
measuring basket.
This was used as, if you were going to go, back when we were in Leviticus and some of those other ones where they would say you're going to have to make a sacrifice, you would make a sacrifice of a bushel of barley, a bushel of rice, an ephah, whatever that word is, meant the measurement. So yes, lead is a measurement. And this basket is a measurement, so it's that much of whatever. But it's supposed to symbolize commerce. You're entirely right. This is the Ephah going forth. Again, he said, this is the appearance in all the land. And behold, a lead cover was lifted up. And this is a woman sitting inside this basket. So this weight, this measurement. This almost sounds like just a, you know, a bad party gone wrong. You know, the woman's got a lead top on and she's getting ready to jump out of this basket. Then he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down into the middle of the basket. I'm going to say basket because it's easier for me to say. And cast the weight on top of its opening. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between the earth and the heavens. And I said to the angel who was speaking with me, where are they taking this basket? Then he said to me, to build a temple for her in the land of Shinar. And when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal.
Yeah, it says Babylonia.
Yeah. Says what?
To the country of Babylonia.
Babylonia, yeah.
No, it's...
So see the country of Babylonia to build a house for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it is ready, the basket will be set there in its place. So they're like, no, we want her.
Exactly. He's putting things back in the place where they should be. Worldly should be in Babylon, and worldly and spiritual should be in spiritual. You need to turn your hearts and minds and souls back to the Ten Commandments, into what I've asked you to do. And send the things of materialism and the things of the world back to where they belong, and quit holding on to those. I had one sermon that I read that I'm taking with a grain of salt, but he was basically, you know, you always get these, oh, the secret places of God. Well, I always take that because there's not that much mystical of God, but what this sermon was saying, when I break it all down, was to be in the will of God. If you're wondering why things aren't quite jiving with you and God, that, you know, you're not quite where you ought to be, that you're not in the place that God had put you. You're trying to struggle with going back to the world, trying to do the things of the world, trying to stay busy, trying to not be in God's will. Do the things God has asked you to do. Live the life that God is asking you to live. pray, think, move, all of these things. And when you do, you will be more in that, quote, secret place of God, because you're in His will and you feel that presence of God. I think we've all probably been there at one time in our life when it was a really special time and you really felt that you had this deep connection. God's still in the same place. We're not following the things He's telling. And this, in a very simple way, is Him relaying that to us, saying, you know, there's a chance that we can get back into His will, do His commandments, and send the things of the world back to the place that they need to be and the place in our life that they need to be, someplace far off.
But we know it's not going to happen, and we know future, realistically, Babylon in the book of Revelation is a mystery religion. So we know she is the harlot that sits on the beast system of commerce. So if you want to kind of connect Revelation to this, she's the religion part that's sitting on the beast system. These two women, symbolic of that?
Some said that they were angelic beings because they were two women with large stork like wings, so they represented angels, and others said that they represented unclean because the stork was an unclean beast.
And that's what I got. You got two women, they're unclean, they're carrying forth commerce. And Shinar means the country of two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates flow through that. Mm-hmm. And what do? They're carrying commerce to Babylon. So that's just my supposition. I'm thinking, you know.
There we go. Well, we got 10 minutes. Let's go ahead and finish up chapter 6. Now I lifted up my eyes again and looked forward and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming forth and from between the two mountains, and the mountains were bronze mountains. Gee whiz. I mean, we got a lot to talk about here. You got bronze mountains. Who are these two bronze mountains? I just passed over like three pages of notes from that last one. I got to look up more. Since the original text says these two mountains, most assume they were the Mount of Olives and the Mount Zion. Mountains of bronze associate these mountains with strength and judgment. Verse 2, with the first chariot were red horses, and the second chariot black horses, and the third chariot white horses, and the fourth chariot strong dappled horses. Now, come on, I know y'all got the answers for all these different colors and the different horses. Y'all are reading all your notes, aren't you? Come on, I know. Everybody's like, well, hold on, I'll be with you in just a minute. Let me get my notes down here.
And maybe they're going to war because they're in chariots. It ain't like the two horses at the first where they were just scouts, so to speak. These are war chariots.
And they're going very fast. Go ahead.
My notes are correct. I'm more confused. Y'all explain to me. So if the four chariots were similar to the four horsemen in the first vision, and these chariots represent the four angels of God's judgment on earth. Mm-hmm. So why the red and dapple one? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anybody else? I love my job. Have I ever mentioned that before? I really love my job. It's a whole lot of fun. I don't know that I believe a lot of what I say, but I do like trying to delve into this sometimes. Four chariots, red horses, black horses, white horses, dappled horses, strong steeds. The horsemen of Zechariah 1 were observed on reconnaissance. The four chariots and their horses seemed to be hostile agents of God's judgment, emissaries of His war against the earth. Some want to identify these four chariots with Daniel's four world empires in Daniel 2 and 7. But the colors essentially are the same as the four horsemen in Revelation 6. The emissaries of God's judgment. Some context with these angelic messengers of judgment in Revelation 7, 1 through 3. In the usual scriptural symbolism, red speaks of war. Black speaks of famine and death, white of victory, and the dappled or the grizzled of pestilence. The four spirits of heaven. This means that these four chariots are actually four angelic beings sent from God. This means that these may not be exactly the same four horsemen of Revelation 6, but that the idea of their mission and purpose is similar. John Calvin said that these angels were compared to horsemen on chariots because these ride swiftly, as it were, through the whole world to execute what God commands them. If Zechariah had the technology of today, he might picture the angels in fast cars or fighter jets, showing how swiftly and powerfully they move across the earth to accomplish God's purpose. To the north country, two of these horses were focused on the north, where Babylon and Magog are. Nevertheless, each of the four extends to and fro throughout the earth. Those who go toward the north country have given rest to my spirit in the north country. God's spirit is only at rest when his enemies and enemies of his people are judged. Questions? Comments? Did I even get far enough in reading? Certain that I just go off. Let me see. Verse 7, when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. And he said, go patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, see, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, take an offering from the exiles, from, and I'm not going to get these names right, Heldijai, Jobijah, and whoever. And you go to the same day into the house of Josiah and the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon. Now, this is the part that I've never read before, and that's just because I'm not that great a scholar. But I had never read about this symbolic crown before, so it really kind of impressed me. Let me start first by saying that it says, take an offering from the exiles. So these people came. We don't know whether they came from Babylon or from another far-off country. It doesn't really state where they came from. Some people postulate that they were from Samaria, so that they were from the northern tribe and weren't even a part of the Babylonians, but they had come back. They wanted to come back into the fold. And this speaks to us as being Gentiles and of Christ opening up his promise to all, not just to those of Israel, but to the people of the world. And so these names, the first one means, it says robust, but I read about three other different things. The second one means God's goodness, and the third one means God knows. McGee sees the intention that God knows that through his goodness, he will put his king on the throne, and he will do it in a robust manner. I haven't even got to that part yet. Let's go to 11. So these guys come back and they have an offering. And normally, they're not taking the offerings from the exiles because they don't want to have things from Babylon that they're going to incorporate into their society here. But God tells them specifically, take this gold and silver that these guys are going to give. Verse 11, and take silver and gold, make an ornate crown, and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Now that totally goes against everything we've ever learned in the Bible. Priests on this side, kings on this side, never the twain shall meet. They both have separate offices. And he's now telling him to make a crown and don't put it on Zedekiah, the king that's already there, or the mayor or whatever. Put it on the head of the high priest. The craziest thing you've ever heard of. And it had to be crazy for him, for Zechariah to hear this. It's like, that totally goes against what we're doing. So what's God setting up here?
I thought of Melchizedek.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You're on the right track.
And Hebrews chapter 7 and Psalms 110, I think, talks about Melchizedek.
And in Genesis, where we first saw him.
Yeah, right. King line and the priest line coming together.
Exactly.
In that one word.
Right. Which there was the Melchizedek of Salem,
exactly.
who Abraham paid a tithe to.
Yeah.
And that's the first time we see him. And Christ is often mentioned as of the line of Melchizedek or whatever, which means that the kingly line and the priestly line will come together, and this is symbolic of when this is going to happen. Now, you got to remember, we've lost the Ark of the Covenant. They no longer have a temple. Remember? It's all gone. Ark's gone. Temple's gone. Everything's gone. And this is where I still am kind of lost. So they rebuild the temple. Do they put another Ark of the Covenant in there? Well, you know they don't have the bud, Aaron's rod that budded, that sprouted.
Yeah.
You know you don't have the Ten Commandments. you know, you don't have the jar of manna, the clay jar of manna. Those were the things that were in there, and they would sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat.
Right.
But why would they build another temple and not have a Holy of Holies? They had a Holy of Holies,
well,
right?
God, remember the first chapter, God said, just build it. Don't worry about what's in it. Remember talking about, told him to go out and get the wood. You just build the temple, and I'm going to, he's going to fill it.
And he's going to fill it. But you don't think that they did in Herod's temple have all the things, the golden lampstands, the, I mean, I don't know. But I'm thinking they did, because they did all the priestly things. I mean, you know, during Passover, everybody's killing lambs, and they're spreading the blood around.
Their tradition.
Hmm? It is their tradition. It's what they do. This is what's interesting to me, because some commentators, well, let me go ahead and finish this, and then I'm gonna tell you what I think is going on here. Verse 12, then say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch. Of course, we would recognize that as being Jesus. For he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple from temple of the Lord. Verse 13, yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be the priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between the two offices. Now the crown will become a reminder in the temple of the Lord to Helam and to these three people, and Hen the son of Jephaniah. And those who are far off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you, and it will take place if you completely obey the Lord your God. This is talking about the temple that Jesus says he's going to build, which is the church, which is Christianity, which is the many membered body. That's what he's talking about, not the temple in particular. Mm-hmm. So, but other commentators had said that when they did rebuild the Ark of the Covenant, that without having all these other things put in there, they put this, they crowned the priest, and then immediately took the crown off the priest, put it into the Ark of the Covenant, and that was their now reminder that a time would come when the priestly class and the kingly class will be joined together in a forever temple, which is what we're getting here. So you're getting a look at what's going to happen in the future when Christ returns. And is that not awesome? Does that not give you chill bumps? I had not read that before, or at least not in that depth before. So I was kind of stoked. Questions, comments? I had one thing I wanted to read y'all, and I'm not going to have a chance to do it today because I got to go with Usher. So maybe I'll read you the illustration another time. Anything else?
Good.
Thank y'all.